Okay, my name is Michaela Hill. I'm interviewing you about the Dayton Arcade.
Hello, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing just wonderful. Thank you.
So first we'll start with some general questions. Mm-hmm. When and where were you born?
I was born in Greer, South Carolina in 1937 and moved to Dayton, Ohio when I was a couple months old. So I've been in Dayton since I was a couple months old, and I grew up in the east side of Dayton.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to Wilbur Wright High School in East Dayton. I graduated in 1955.
Do you remember your grandparents?
No, I do not. Like many African Americans, we migrated up, and then I didn't go back to the South very much. My parents divorced when I was in the first grade, so we stopped going back. So I don't remember my grandparents at all. I've seen pictures of them since, but I don't have a recollection.
And do you remember your earliest memory?
My earliest memory? Oh, not my earliest memory. I don't know what this is, but I remember the feeling of my childhood. I feel fortunate. As a matter of fact, sometimes when I go around to other parts of the country, I do a lot of motivational speaking for teenagers. I always talk about two of my blessings, and two of my great blessings was being born black and growing up in East Dayton. And the reason I said that is growing up in East Dayton was a small 4th Street enclave of African Americans, and coming from the South with that extended family concept, we were able to maintain that extended family concept. So that meant that as we played and moved around the neighborhood, all the children belonged to everybody. And so I got disciplined by neighbors as well as disciplined by my parents, but I got motivation. And so that unique experience added to my vision and goal. So I remember having a positive childhood experience as a result of that, even though as I got older they told me we were poor. And sometimes even on welfare. But a mother raised 6 of us by herself and didn't get remarried until the baby left the house. But yeah, I had a very rich experience that has guided me in my vision and goal to become an artist and then a teacher, and then also now a community activist using my art to rebuild community.
Did you have a nickname? How did you get it?
Yeah, I do. I haven't found out yet. My nickname is Bing, B-I-N-G. And when I would ask my brothers and sisters and other family members, they would joke about it, and I've never found out, but it stuck all the way through. They told me that when I came along, being the 4th child, the family always had a pet dog. And the dog was named Bingo. And so when I came along, I was about the size of a little dog, and so they thought, oh, it's another Bingo. But they said when we went out to play, and my mother would call, Bingo, time to come home. Me and the dog both would run home. And they said the dog got embarrassed by being associated, and so they cut mine short to Bing. So I never really found out. There was a couple other stories they told me. But I do know, I remember going to school in the first grade and the teacher sending a note home telling, Dear Mrs. Davis, your son Willis has not been in school. Because when the teacher called a roll call and said Willis Davis, I'd never heard it. I'd only heard Bing. So I didn't know that was my real name. And so I got chastised again for not going to school, but I was at school. I just looked around and she said Willis. But it just stuck. It's just a nickname that stuck in elementary. When I got to high school, it stuck. When I got to college, you had to sign in to get your financial aid. So I had Willis Davis. But when people find out my nickname, they just call me by my nickname.
Okay. And are you married?
Yes. I'm married. I'm a newlywed. That was my wife who just walked through. We've been married 43 years.
Can you tell me about your spouse?
Yes, I can. I can tell you a lot, particularly since she's not here. But she's a very, very special person. Because I remember growing up, and my mother So then you have to learn how to cook and learn how to sew and learn how to wash clothes, because nobody wants to marry an artist. You're going to be a starving. she has been very, very special. She's been supportive of my vision and my goal to be an artist. And also, now that we both retired from teaching, her in elementary and me, lastly, at the university, she has worked with me even here as I took the studio, which was four blocks from here, out of our home. I usually worked in the attic or the basement or the kitchen, and then put it right here in the heart of this community because we want to be a part of its revitalization. And so she has been right with me and supportive of that, which was just a vision and a dream. And a difficult dream now that we're both retired is to restart a whole nother career. So I am pretty close to being 82 years of age. So I'll be making another shift this year and cut back again and decide what we want to do with this space we've been working in since 2004 of making art and working with other artists. I work with artists in the community, and we do a summer camp for kids. So she's been right there with me, and very talented herself. I met her, I was teaching at DePaul University in Indiana, where I went to undergraduate school, and she was teaching elementary school in Indianapolis, which is the closest big city to Greencastle. And that's how I met her when she was a teacher. And she agreed to come over to Ohio, since I wanted to come back and do the final phase of my career here in my hometown.
Do you two have children?
Yeah, we have two. I have a son who is in his 40s from a previous marriage. Matter of fact, when I met my current wife, I was a single parent of a five-year-old and teaching at the university and wanting to be an artist. And we have a daughter who's 33 now, in social work in San Antonio, Texas. Both of them are creative. My son took radio and TV, but he also is an artist and is on exhibit here with us. So in the gallery here is my work, my wife's work, and my son's work. And I have a lot of nieces and nephews. And all the kids that I taught, I consider mine. And that's from 1960 to the present.
How about grandkids?
No grandkids as yet. No grandkids as yet. But we'll adopt you. No, we don't. We look forward to it, though. Neither my son, who's 47, or our daughter, who's 33, are married. But we're hoping for some grandkids.
And moving on, what do you do for a living?
What do I do for a living? Since retiring, I was a teacher almost all of my adult life. I taught from 1960, 2 months after graduating from college, undergraduate, until 98, and I retired in 98. And so this is like after those, you have to wait a little time after you retire, and so about 6 months after retiring, then we could go back into the workforce. And so I'm here every day that I'm in town, other than Sunday. Sometimes I come in on Sunday. But we both are here making art. My wife's studio is right next door. She's a jewelry maker. And underneath is a pottery place. There's a lady upstairs who's our office manager, Mrs. Green. And above us is a library of all those books that I use at the university in teaching art and African history. And African history is available for anyone who wants to come in and read them or borrow them. And so we're here. And then I sell my work. So there's examples of my work with most of the universities in the area, hospitals in the area, and individuals and in private collectors.
What was it like to work at university in comparison to working as an artist?
That's a good point. It's a very close working at the university as well as working as an artist. A good question. I I enjoy the making of art, and second to the joy of making it is sharing it, and that's what I call teaching. And so I've always taught, and even before I was a formal teacher, I can remember as a teenager and working in the community center and at the church, I was one of those kind of individuals, probably where you were, that was helping with the Sunday school and helping with the youth group or helping whoever was working with the kids. I had always been in that kind of a mode, and so teaching was very natural to me. But there's a distinct difference between making the work and teaching. But when I taught in the art area. I taught about art and about how to teach art. What I also do and did even then is find ways to develop art activities and workshops in the community to help those learn to appreciate art or learn to just discover more about themselves. So it's been art all along, and that's strange because I never considered ever doing anything else. Because in the fifth grade is when I made a vocal commitment in the school that I'm going to be an artist when I grow up in the fifth grade, and I've never thought of anything else other than wanting to be an artist and wanting to share it.
What do you like to do in your spare time? Do you have any hobbies?
I like to read. I didn't always, but I think I got that from my wife, because she reads a lot. But I enjoy reading, mainly about art and history and culture, I think reading, and then going to see plays and musicals and exhibits, and I've always enjoyed working with groups. I went to school on a basketball and track scholarship, but I always did art. But so there was a point in time, and when I went to college, my commitment was to come back to my high school and teach art and coach basketball. That was what, when I went off to school, that was already in the plans ever since I was 15 from the high school that I went to. They were anticipating me coming back as a former star athlete to one day come back to the high school, teach art and coach basketball.
And getting to the Dayton Arcade, what are your first memories of the Dayton Arcade?
The ceilings, the beauty of the ceiling, and the turkeys that were going around the top of it that were handmade and hand-painted, and just the sheer beauty of that interior space. Because I was probably going down there with my mother, because they had grocery stores and fish that you could get in there, fresh vegetables and even live fish. The awness of the building itself is what I remember, because to me it was probably the one of the most interesting and prettiest spots in Dayton. So if we went downtown to shop, you went downtown to go to the movies, or if you went downtown for whatever reason, you usually try to find a reason to go through the arcade. I know now that there's at least seven buildings that is attached to it. So there's little dime stores and other stores that you can go into and go right into it, into the arcade itself that were attached and accessible. It was just probably the most interesting place to go in Dayton that had an interior. Yeah, that's what I remember. And then the activity, you know, all these things were the vendors and all the different people. And different dress and the languages that you heard, it was an experience to go, and particularly if you can imagine for a young kid to walk into a building almost like a cathedral or a church, you know, have this big glass ceiling with all these interesting things around it and all the color and the shape and the pattern. So that's what I remember about the arcade.
Why did you visit the arcade?
Well, you know what? I visited the arcade because I didn't want to get lost from my mother. You know, usually that's what usually at first that's how I was getting in there. And, you know, going with her to shop, get groceries, help carry the things home. And usually, it, from where I grew up, it meant on a bus. You could walk, but it was over a mile. So it meant on the bus. But yeah, I had fond memories of the arcade. And then as you got older, you go in on your own. I mean, if you go down for a movie on Saturday or Sunday, usually it's a lot on Saturday mornings, you could go watch the cowboy movies for 10 cents. And then you could go in there to grab a sandwich or eat there or get knickknacks or just experience it. It's probably the way. I don't know if you, when you were in high school, if there was some place you could go to meet other people your age. That was used to be a little places to eat. I know you guys had Frisch's, you know, the big boy. You'd have some place like that, but that was a gathering place too to go. It was a night, it wasn't one that was rowdy because there was just so many adults and so many people there. But yeah, I can remember just going there even as I got older.
Did you at any time work in the arcade?
No, I didn't. I would have if I enjoyed it. I think the time I was doing those little odd jobs, I was probably washing cars at filling stations, you know, or cutting grass, you know, with lawnmowers, getting the lawnmower and go around the neighborhood looking for a job. But I never did have a job there. But one, it was, you could get down there on one bus, but you also had, what you said, have transfer. You can get, and I lived out that there was a small bus that came that could hook you up on the main line, and with the transfer ticket, or you can walk to a certain spot and get a bus all the way down. But it was also close enough that I got to be a teenager that you could walk it. It's a little bit over a mile, but you mile and a half, you could walk down. Downtown, easy from the neighborhood and back.
What places, shops, restaurants, etc., did you visit in the arcade? Any specific memories about them?
No, I don't remember any names of the vendors, but usually it was most frequently where they sold sandwiches. But they had big fish markets, so you could get fresh fish sandwiches. Or they have the hamburgers and the fries and the things that you eat as a young person, as a teenager. But I don't remember any particular store other than just the fish market.
What did the arcade look like on the inside?
That's a good question. It looked like, to me, as I reflect back now, I may have my adult memory and experience to think about it, but it reminded me of a cathedral. Just because it was so big and awe-inspiring for a young person, and with the way the space was, because I remember you had this big space here, but you also could go down, and as you walked around, it was like a big church. It was awe-inspiring for a younger person to go in that building. And you almost automatically have a reverence for it. You usually felt the need to, just not drop trash anywhere, but it was a special place. But there was always a lot of people there, too. But you had the big space, and it seemed to me the glass, but the that was interesting to walk in a building that had a glass dome ceiling, because you wondered, how are those pieces of glass staying up? You don't know the architecture and the structure, but that's all inspiring for a young person to look up and see just total glass, other than the divisions and the framing. But it was a very special feeling and experience to walk into it, because it was also clean and brightly colored, and so had no other building like it in Dayton. There was no other building like it in Dayton, so you knew it was special. Then where it was, being in the center of town, you knew it was special. And it did seem like a place where people can come from any direction and all over. I remember it was all good feelings I had. It wasn't, because you can go in some places and you can feel like, boy, they don't want me here. You don't feel welcome, or you don't feel comfortable. But it always felt like a comfortable place. It may have been, may not have been, but it didn't feel like it to me.
Do you remember any people that may have worked there, or what would be there when you would visit it?
No, other than the familiar faces of the people where you would shop. The sandwich place, you'd probably see the same person. I remembered seeing the people who had to wear the aprons because they were cutting up meat and handling fish. That was a part of it. You almost thought that they never left. They were always there when you got there. You thought they almost lived there. But yeah, that's what I remember mostly, and the people and the vendors and the shop owners and the people who worked in the stores. They almost became familiar faces.
Do you know any people that may have lived in the apartments above the arcade?
No. As a matter of fact, as growing up, you didn't have a full sense of the full operation of what all was there. And really, you probably frequented the same places. You probably went to the same, maybe not even experienced all of it. But I remember coming in from 3rd Street, some of the smaller shops would change every so often. But there was always a few that had a lot of knickknacks and things to look at. Because you would go in just to look. You didn't buy a lot when you're young. You don't buy it, but you look, you're just going around checking stuff out. You know? But yeah, it was an experience for me. And I was sad to see it close, and I'm happy to see that it may be coming back, because it is special.
Can you tell us about the people and friends with whom you visited the arcade with?
Ooh, those are the people I grew up with. Even adults taking you down may take one or two other people, either you knew or friends with you, to help entertain yourselves while they're shopping, or either provide an opportunity. So many times, if there was other people other than family, it was just close friends and neighbors, kids, who either wanted to go along just for the experience or maybe being babysit and going where you go. And then as you got to be a teenager, you went with your clique, you went with your posse. You had your own running partners, just like what you guys did when the malls, when you go to the mall. Either you meet there, or you hook up and go there. Yeah, and it was about the same. Yeah, we were just like you guys, just it was a long time ago. Yeah.
What are your strongest memories of the arcade?
My strongest memories of arcade, and I thought about that today, was the visual, seeing it, and the smells. You have those aromas. You may have some fish here, but you have other foods here, and you have all the different perfumes that might be. So it was a sensory kind of experience too. So that's what I remember. Now, if you're going and waiting to get some fish to go home, it may have a strange smell, but it was fresh. And if there was things cooking where you can get the sandwiches, then that, so the aromas and the various aromas, you can move from one area to another and you pick up another scent. So that the visual and the sensory kind of experience is what was a part of it. You couldn't get away from it. You go where they may have selling a lot of makeup. And, I know how you guys are always doing that stuff and you're going through the buildings and putting little samples on, and it's there in the atmosphere. That was part of the experience.
Can you think of any specific event at the arcade, such as Christmas time or anything?
No, I knew that it was, when you went down during the holidays, you always had a reflection of the holiday there. So Christmas would be special, and Easter would be special. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, you would pick up that. And I'm trying to think about flowers. You mean, I mean, there's a place we can get flowers too, but that's part of that sensory experience. But whatever holiday was prevalent or coming, because of what it was, it would be reflected someplace in there.
Do you recall any encounter or seeing any problems in the arcade, such as segregation or crime or anything?
Not until near the close, when it was starting to go down a little bit, and there wasn't as much activity. And like with any place in any city, that when it's going down is when the usually there weren't enough people there to keep it live and active, or leaving it for almost the undesirable, someone who's just almost panhandling and just looking for problems. But simply what we had happen many of the malls, people coming not intending to buy just to get in the way. I don't remember that phase of it. I don't remember that phase of it. And I left the city in 1955 to go off to college, and then come back to 59. And I left again, so in 70. So there's two periods that I was away from college, and then when I went back to teach at the college, and then I came back to the city. It had closed during one of those periods there, but when I came back the last time in the 70s, it had already been closed for a while. Yeah, and I've seen and heard of discussions over the years to reopen it, and reclaim it, and revitalize it. And this is the closest to those times now, because I remembered after being back, being in discussion, but never got to this point where we start to interview people about it or talk about it. But I had been aware of efforts being made over the years to try to rekindle it.
And what did people think about the arcade in general? Did that change over time?
Well, I don't know. I know when you say change over time, there has been, and I've been in public discussions and meetings and planning sessions during the last 20 years. Of discussions at various points about it. And there has been individuals and people for and against opening it, rekindling it. But we also had what happened too in many, many cities, particularly either chocolate cities or urban cities, where there was a hesitancy to do anything downtown, because we've gotten so suburban-oriented that we want to do it outside the city. So there's been individuals who maybe even today would prefer, don't put the effort there, because that's in downtown Dayton and it's not going to go. So the negative perception of what's possible. I don't recall any concentrated effort not to, but I just know human nature. That I'm sure there's people who say, well, let's take that money and do something someplace else. But I think I've learned over the years, the last 15, 20 years, that every city must embrace its entire community if it's going to grow and revitalize and not really, really die on the vine. Refurbishing an entity like the arcade in the heart of downtown Dayton is vital. And I've learned that even our most solvent and effective and strong suburban area won't survive without the entire area surviving. So it's not enough to just have some place you can run to, because all the problems that we're trying to address will eventually touch every neighborhood, and that's what we're seeing, even with the difficulty with the problems we're having with prescription drugs in suburban areas, where it's not, where you don't have the urban core. But happened, what we saw happen with the drug scene and the crime scene, it isn't about the core of the neighborhood. It's a problem that we as a country and a region got to solve.
So what did you think that the arcade meant to the people of Dayton?
Oh, that's a good question. You know what? I know for a fact that it was a point of pride for Dayton. You could hear people talk, and they leaned on it, and they took advantage of that unique experience, and took it was a source of pride because it was special visually, philosophically, economically. It was special. And like many things that we lose, we lamented about it and complained about it. But I thought it had a lot of positive meaning. But just because it was special to have a building like that, which did more than just enclosed space, but it was aesthetically pleasing, architecturally strong. So it was special. And I think it could be again. As a matter of fact, I know many cities take entities like that and rebuild around them. Let them become special places that's worthy of that extra effort it takes to make it become solvent and effective again. And it's worth it.
And then, in terms of living in the dark in Dayton area.
In terms of what?
In terms of living in Dayton, mm-hmm. How long did you live in Dayton, and when and why did you move from Dayton?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and a good question for me. But it also is a strange question because you're asking someone who loves Dayton. As I alluded to earlier, during two blocks of time I haven't lived in Dayton, when I went off to college, and then that undergraduate college came back and recruited me while I was teaching public school to come back and be the first black faculty full-time at that university in 1970. So I went back to my undergraduate school, which was a small private church school, and I stayed there for 7 years. And after the end of that 7 years, I had met my current wife, and I was resigning where I was teaching and deciding what I was going to do with the second phase of my life. I looked at my home state of South Carolina, who I left when I was 35 days old, in the city. And I looked at some major art areas like New York, San Francisco, and Chicago. And I looked at some chocolate cities like Atlanta and Dayton. And it was hard to determine what I was going to do. But after agonizing and making those normal lists of should I go, should I stay, positive, negative, good, bad, I told my fiance that I've decided and I'm going back to Dayton. I came back to Dayton after looking at those other cities, which I knew I could go any place I wanted, and many of my colleagues and friends in the art field around the country, that by this time I had gotten somewhat of a reputation that would allow me to go in any city and be an artist and an educator. And they said, go to where you feel the most nurtured. If you're going to make it as an artist, and you're not in New York, Chicago, or San Francisco, it may take you longer, but go to where you're nurtured and happy. And I came back to Dayton. So I get teased by some of my friends in the art community that I'm working with around the city, because I do care for Dayton, and I found Dayton to be an inspiring place where I can make my work, and where I can be nurtured, and where I can feel comfortable, in spite of all of its problems, like many people have. But it was a positive choice, a decision to deliberately come back and to also consciously be a part of the rebuilding. I knew my good friend who, I just put her book away, who's in Westchester, Dr. Maslumi, a leading art historian and scholar. I knew I could afford and could live wherever we wanted to. If we both teach, we both make art, credit was okay, that any Centerville, Oakwood, Beaver Creek, Westchester, wherever I wanted to live, we could afford to live. And I consciously live for the 43 years I've been back, three blocks from here, in this neighborhood that's trying to come back and trying to revitalize. It was risky because I had two kids, and I know there were crack houses in the neighborhood. I know there was things that were going on that was good. It was risky that they might get involved, but they both turned out okay. That decision was good for me and positive. Dayton has his problems. When my colleagues tease me, boy, you're always singing the praises of Dayton. It's for a purpose. It's a unique place. Mm. Matter of fact, we're hoping some of the outstanding, brilliant students at UD will see that, and when they graduate and get their law degrees, they'll come back to Dayton and help us. All right? Okay. That's when I was asking you guys questions. We're always looking for good people.
Can you tell me about Dayton when you were younger?
Mm-hmm. Dayton was a lot bigger. And a good example of that is that when I was in high school, there's four high schools now, and there was 11. So it's gone from maybe over 300,000 down to 150,000. So it's changed in terms of the scale and the size. It's always had, matter of fact, I didn't know at the time of growing up, I didn't realize how segregated the city was, and is. It still has a lot to do. It had enough positive things and enough positive people here to be a good city for raising kids. I think its best days are still in front of it. It's had some outstanding days in the past and some outstanding people. Matter of fact, there was a time when Dayton was the number one city for patents and inventions in the entire country. So it has a historical fact. And individuals. But I find it to be a good place, and I'm glad I made the decision that I did make to come back and be a part of it.
What changes have you seen in your neighborhood since you first moved here?
Have I seen changes where?
In your neighborhood.
In my neighborhood? Oh, wow. Of course, there have been many changes. I count this Wright Dunbar as a part of my neighborhood because I'm in the Dayton View, which is the first neighborhood just beyond this historical area being revitalized, but it flows right into the other. I've seen it when it was better. I've seen it go down, and I see it now making an effort to come back. I saw there's a bunch of young people, just a little bit older than you two, that are working this past 2 years to bring the first grocery store back into the neighborhood called Gem City Market, which is going to happen 3 blocks from here. And that's all as a result of some of the young people in this area and connected with some of the places like UD and Wright State where some of the research has gone on. So I see that happening. I've seen the neighborhood, which I'm fortunate to be a part of. I'm looking at a photograph of elders. Individuals 60 years and older, professionals, retired professionals, have formed a group called the Elders Council. And these are some individuals in the community. A retired law professor at the University of Dayton was one of the founders of this. The judges, chemists, historians, who come together, volunteer their services to share with some of the young professionals like you guys and older, up to maybe between 20 and 30, 35, about building community and doing it on a historical African foundation of coming together and working together, and almost around the principles of Kwanzaa. That's what they use as a history. But I see these kinds of things happen, which couldn't have happened a few years ago, because it's all volunteer. Taking that you've been a professional, you've gained some knowledge and wisdom and expertise, now you're in a retirement age. Do you go home and sit? Or do you find some way to nurture and share some of that with those coming up so they can become leaders? And we've got elders, and we've got warriors and community builders working from just below this group is a group of college kids and a new employees, kids who've been in their career maybe 1 or 2 years, who are going to be decision makers. And this group meets with them and shares knowledge and wisdom so it can help them make good decisions. Yeah, so I see some things like that happening. I need to tap into some of the expertise that are in the area and resources that are in the area and better affiliate and network with some of the other institutions, Wright State, University of Dayton, Sinclair Community College, which is one of the top community colleges in the United States, Clark State, and Springfield, Edison State, and Troy, finding ways to help build the entire infrastructure of employment opportunities for diversity and inclusion. So there's some positive things going on in the midst that we still, if we're not number one, we're now number three in terms of most segregated city in America, with redlining but we got some outstanding people who are here who are doing some positive things. Premier Health, Miami Valley Hospital, the outstanding and gifted Eric Spinner, president of the University of Dayton. Yeah. So there's some positive things going on that I think is going to give some good results.
And what do you do for fun in Dayton?
What do I do for fun and date? a lot of things. I almost said leave. No. We were talking about that just yesterday, because there's more to do in dating than people realize. For example, we have probably either number two or number three top contemporary black dance company in the United States, called the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company. If there's one better, it would be in Harlem. But they're 50 years old. That's rare for a city our size. We have a chorus of artists and musicians. I was talking with a gentleman today about this particular area in terms of the history of jazz and music. Matter of fact, you're in the neighborhood. I call some names. If you don't know them, you should. The Ohio Players, Lakeside, Heatwave, Platypus, Slave. Those are funk musicians that came out of this neighborhood during the 70s, 80s, and 90s were the top funk musicians in the world. Just out of this, you take a circle of 5 miles, and all these musicians came right out of here. So there's a Dayton is special. That's when I get teased when I go around the country and I'm sharing these things. There's a group of artists that I work with. You call emerging artists. These are artists all from within 5 miles of here, other than the one who lives in Westchester. But he teaches at St. Clair, so we count him as being here. And one retired, but he's in Georgia, went back to Georgia, but he still works with us. But for the last 7 years, no, we started in 2007. So once a year, I challenge this group of artists at Barry's as to who's going to be participating. And we've been doing a series called Dayton Skyscrapers. And in this series, we're not talking about the skyline of Dayton. Our skyscrapers that we collaborate with Victoria Theater Association in Schuster, we identify African Americans, deceased or alive, from this community who has excelled in their field and given back to help make the quality of life of Dayton. And this is the 11th year. This artist, who used to teach at Central State, did the painting of Judge Arthur O. Fisher, and he was one of the most important and first black judges here in Dayton, to the point that the park is named for him. And when they relocated the fairgrounds, they relocated at the park that's named for this gentleman here, who came to Dayton and made a contribution. This lady found one of the earlier ladies in charge of suffrage and women's rights at the turn of the century. This young lady, who has a doctorate degree, has a nonprofit that she's working with 1 million teenage girls around the country to help them realize their full potential as women and as scholars. So she became a skyscraper. This guy was the first black engineer, right, Pat, for 30-some years, and a former athlete. The person I did is this lady here, and we called it Phyllis Bowles and the Invisible Airplane. This lady in high school, at Dunbar High School, the largest black school here, graduated first in a class, valedictorian, and then went to Central State, the leading HBCU in this area, a small black school and senior, and graduated magna cum laude in physics, right from this neighborhood. And Wright-Patterson Air Force Base hired her. So for 15 years, this was one of the leading scientists to make the number one airplane in the world, the stealth bomber. She worked on this to help bring this into fruition. So that's the second most important airplane in the world, the first being the Wright brothers, the Kitty Hawk. This places America first in defense, because it cannot be detected by radar, they caused it. All from this neighborhood. So, this young man born in Dayton, Alfonso Trumbull, I know him, but the artist researched him. Jefferson Township, just a little suburb of Dayton, a small educational area of a high school with about 300 kids. He graduated from that school, but he's now a colonel and leading a Marine base in Albany, Georgia, who just rose through the ranks. So what we do, current judge, this gentleman here, if someone is shot, he's a first responder. He has a group of former felons from convicts in the reentry program that the police gets there and they call him and his crew, because he's there as soon as there's a problem of guns, and begin to work with the community and the kids to quell. And he's considered a skyscraper and an important community. So, so all of these, well, there's 13, and since 2007, we've identified all these black scholars and contributors who make Dayton what it is, as a means of expanding the role models for urban youth, providing opportunities for other artists beside me, and providing opportunities for the white community to appreciate what contributions African Americans have made to the quality of life in Dayton. And so that's what we do. Yeah.
What's your favorite part of Dayton and your least favorite part of Dayton?
What's my favorite part of Dayton and what's the other part?
What's your least favorite?
My least favorite? Oh, that's a good question. First part's easy. I can't think of a. I can't think of a favorite spot, but I've thought of a view. There's a. If I go this, go west. There's a street called Mount Clair, and it's a short street. And if you drive it, and you look back east, you can see this neighborhood and see downtown, and it's a view that is so scenic. I like it. Matter of fact, when you used to date, you used to go over there and just to sit with your girl and look at that view. Least favorite, I named that way because and it's hard to answer, is that you have filters. Each of us, you have filters that I can experience something that may appear to be bad, but I can try to pull something positive from it. And so I don't make that definitive versus the least. It's the ugliest view I've ever seen. That's it. So I hadn't thought about maybe just what I was thinking, but I can't think of any one particular place that the most beautiful or the worst. I just don't think that way. I run whatever I'm experiencing through. And for me, I can't linger, maybe because that old song they used to have, "You're Too Young, Accentuate the Positive, Eliminate the Negative." It used to be a song that had those lines in there. I can't think of. There are probably some places that are not pleasing to look at, but it made me think of. I mentioned about washing cars and those odd jobs and cutting grass. I was going to, which was common. A lot of education in America and schools, I can remember, I didn't know it at the time, that most of the black friends I had, and particularly the males, were placed on the general track in school. That means you just take the least amount of courses you can take to get out of school. I said the general track means it also had no college preparatory courses. You just come in and you take as little as you can and get on out, and then when you get to be 16, you can drop out of school and get a work permit. And in my neighborhood, that's what most of the boys did. So for me to have that goal was sort of special, that hey, I'm going to be an artist. But I was prepared to drop out of school. And when I was going to drop out of school, because I was the only of the six kids, I didn't have a hustle. I didn't have a little odd job helping my mother financially. But I was also the tallest and the biggest, but I was the one that wasn't working. All of them, my brothers and sisters, they babysat, they ran errands for older people, they cut grass, they did what they could, and some of what they earned you gave to mama to help pay the bills. But not me, because I was playing football, basketball, and track, and I was always in season. But it was not fun, because it was difficult to ask my mother for 35 cents for lunch every day, when I knew what the situation was at home. So I couldn't wait to get to be 16 so I could get my work permit and drop out of school and go. I knew where I was going because that's where most of the boys went. There was a Fogies Meatpacking or a bleach bottling company that would hire us. It's just labor and physical. When my coach heard that I was dropping out of school and I was a star basketball player and star on the track team, he came into the neighborhood from Oakwood, where he lived. His father was a doctor at Miami Valley Hospital, and he had gone to DePaul, and that's how I got there, because he came in the neighborhood and said, get your butt back in school, you have some potential. I said, but coach, I need a job. He called his dad at Miami Valley Hospital, and his dad called the housekeeping department and explained my situation, and I got a job. That's the first time I wasn't washing cars in the filling station down the street. So I could go to the Miami Valley Hospital and mop floors anytime we didn't have a game away. If I was home and we had a game in town, I could go on Saturday or Sunday and put in some hours, and then I didn't have an excuse for dropping out of school because I could buy my own lunch. But we're talking about a job. From that job, and wanting to make a little bit more because college is getting close, he drove me to DePaul, where he went to school, and his mother went to school, and his father went to school, and convinced them to give me a scholarship to see if I could do college work, even though I had not taken any college prep classes, and then no SAT, no Miller exam, nothing but just potential. And on his word and his father's word, they gave me a scholarship. In the summer, my dad, who lived on the other side of town and worked for the city disposal plant, he was a garbage man, got me a job that can help over the summer. And that job, I served everybody in Dayton. So I went from it being mopping floors and had a little bit better pay and a little bit longer hours at the disposal plant. And my job was at, which was only 3 blocks from here. This is Broadway. If you go to Gunther, there's a building. And I say I served everybody in Dayton. He said, if you flush the toilet, it came to me. And my job was to just watch these two diesel pumps. It's pulling in what we call sludge, pulling in all everything that people had flushed down their toilet. And if it had a that means it was getting stopped up, and my job was to turn off these diesel pumps in a certain sequence, take off the cap, and take a hook with gloves and unstop it. And then put it back and reverse it, turn it back on, and keep pulling whatever people flush in the toilet into the city to be processed. That was my job. I could do that. And on my shift, in between, I could draw, sketch, eat my lunch, and just remember what my mother said. And that was, the man makes the job doesn't make the man. And that's my job for now. It doesn't mean I have to stay there. But I don't know if that answers all your questions, but go ahead, do you have any other questions?
This concludes our interview. Once again, my name is Michaela Hill, and your name is?
My name is Willis Bing Davis.
And we had this interview on the 3rd of March, the 22nd, 2019, at Willis Bing Davis's studio.